Harvey Wasserman's Green Power and Wellness Show, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
300 years ago, Sir Thomas More invented the word utopia, where everything was going to be hunky-dory. But now we know it's going to be a green-powered Earth, and that'll be solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia.
All right. How are you today? We are back here in Solartopia, where the world is powered by solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, biofuels, increased efficiency, mass conservation, mass transit, all that great stuff. You were listening to Pete Seeger and the great Dar Williams, along with David Burns and the Rivertown Kids, singing the song for Solartopia. We are honored again to be joined today by Joe Cirincione, executive director of the Plowshares Foundation, which works for nuclear disarmament, among other things. We were talking last week about the crisis in Iran, or the manufacturing crisis in Iran, or the non-crisis in Iran, which has actually turned into a crisis in Iowa, since we have so many Republicans who seem to want to take us into another wonderful war. In the second half hour, Joe will be with us, and he's on the line now. Joe, you're there? Joe?
Yes, I'm with you, Harvey.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. At 2:30, we'll be joined by Paul Gunter. He may tune in a little earlier. Paul is from the superb organization Beyond Nuclear. He will be talking today about proliferation of nuclear power plants. And I have a piece today at Huffington Post about how 2012 will be the year we bury nuclear power. If you want to do a little homework prior to the 2:30 arrival of Paul Gunter, that would be fine. And go take a look at that piece if you would. Joe, last week we were talking about Iran and the apparent overwhelming desire of numerous politicians to get us into another war in Iran. And you very kindly pointed out that there are mere 79 million people in Iran. We talked to you last year. Now we're in a new year, and what has changed, if anything?
Well, the rhetoric is starting to translate into some military maneuvers in the Gulf that could actually have us slipping into a war that neither side really wants. I think there's essentially two things going on here, Harvey, and as one of you pointed out, the rhetoric in the campaign is growing on the bomb Iran side. Uh-huh. So you have Republican candidates competing for the right-wing constituency of that party for whom Iran is a touchstone issue. And they believe that by calling for tough measures, including bombing Iran, as Rick Santorum has said, putting our nuclear weapons on alert and warning Iran that we will fire them at that nation, as Michelle Bachmann has said, or simply keeping the military option front and center on the table, as Romney has said, all of them are using this as their as the issue to prove their national defense bona fides. So that's, and we can expect that kind of rhetoric to continue all during the primaries over the next 3 or 4 months. What's also happening is in the Gulf itself, Iran is starting to experience some severe economic dislocation as a result of the sanctions they've been put under. These are sanctions that have been authorized by the United Nations and then added to by the European Union, Japan, South Korea, the United States itself. And there's been real economic dislocation as a result of this that has now gone far beyond the elite and is starting to affect the whole economy. The Iranian currency, the rial, suffered a 12% decline yesterday.
Just wow.
Yesterday, it dropped 12%, basically because of the new sanctions that the president signed into, or the potential for new sanctions that the U.S. president signed into law over the last couple of days, and calls in the European Union for more sanctions on Iran. That currency just tumbled. As a result of that, you see the Iranian government starting to act, sort of at least have a more belligerent rhetoric to match what they think is coming from the U.S. side. So they've made warnings about closing the Straits of Hormuz. Today, the Iranians warned that if the U.S. brought an aircraft carrier back into the Persian Gulf, this is the USS Stennis that has been stationed in the Persian Gulf, moved over the last week out into the Arabian Sea and is scheduled to come back in the Persian Gulf, they warned that if that aircraft carrier came back, there would be severe consequences.
What would those consequences be?
Well,
what would you expect?
It's hard to say, but I'll tell you, you know, this is a U.S. aircraft carrier. This is a very large war vessel. It is extremely difficult to mount an effective attack against a U.S. aircraft carrier, but that doesn't mean they couldn't try. And there have been Revolutionary Guard exercises. The Revolutionary Guard is one part of Iran's military, and there's a naval component of that, and they have engaged in exercises where they do swarming attacks. That is, small patrol boats swarm on an intended target, presumably to take the place of a U.S. war vessel, and they swarm over it and fire cruise missiles at it, small arms fires, try to get close and plant explosives on the vessel. It's possible that you could see some kind of action like that. So the fear is that this belligerent talk, both on the campaign trail and now in the Gulf, could produce an incident at sea that could escalate and to bring us into a war that at this point neither side, the United States or the Iran, really wants. This is the way, unfortunately, most wars start. That is, they're not like World War II, you know, or the Iraq War that start with an intentional attack by one side and the other. Most wars are more like the Vietnam War or World War I, where a small incident escalates into a greater conflict. That's, I think, the biggest fear at this point.
Wow. We're talking with Joe Cimincione, the executive director of the Plowshares Fund, which works on nuclear disarmament, and now working to prevent, God forbid, a war with Iran, which has become a major macho talking point, and that includes Michelle Bachmann. In Iowa, these guys seem to be falling, except for Ron Paul.
Notable exception,
yeah.
who on this issue talks a lot of sense.
Yes, and you know, seem to be falling over each other to get us into a war that you say nobody really, well, neither side
well,
really wants, but somebody...
Neither side, neither government really wants, but in each government there are factions that I believe seek a conflict. They want a conflict. I would say the Obama administration does not want to go to war with Iran. I don't think the supreme leader in Iran wants a conflict with the United States, but there are factions. For example, there are some in Iran who seem to believe that a conflict would be a good thing, that this would consolidate support for a failing regime. You know, the Iranian regime is a thuggish regime that has very little popular support. It has ruined the country. It is not, you know, if there was a free election, they'd be voted out. So let's not have any illusions about the country, that the leadership that we're dealing with here. And there are some who believe an attack, a conflict, would be a good thing. In fact, it may be that some of this rhetoric is designed for exactly that, you know, to shore up, to make a nationalist cause, to shore up the flag and support. And by the way, it raises the price of oil. So the price of oil has gone up today because of this rhetoric, which benefits Iran. So, and then in the U.S.
So you're saying the Iranian currency has plummeted by 12%.
Yes. Yes.
How much has the oil gone up?
It's gone up by $5 a barrel. Just today. I didn't see the latest cost, but it's a little about $107 a barrel. I'd have to go check it.
Uh-huh.
It's been hovering around 100.
Well, since you mentioned that, how high do you think oil would go if we did have a conflict, a war conflict with Iran?
most experts believe that the price of oil would go past $200 a barrel and could go to $300 a barrel.
So basically double.
Yes, if there was a war in Iran, if you shut down the Straits of Hormuz. The Straits of Hormuz are about 50 mile wide strait that connects the Persian Gulf to the Arabian Sea. About 20% of the world's oil supply goes through the Straits of Hormuz. In fact, if you calculate it on the actual seaborne traffic, it's almost a third. So a third of all oil transported by sea goes through that strait. You shut down the straits, you shut down the supply of oil. Depending how long the straits are closed, the price of, you know, the price of oil goes up. Insurance rates for tankers zoom up. So it becomes much more costly to transport the oil. All of this would lead to $200, perhaps even more, per barrel costs for the oil, which would, if it's continued for a period of weeks, would probably trigger a recession, a new setback for the global economy.
Well, we're talking.
So there are huge economic consequences to the war, way beyond what you think you can accomplish militarily. The economic consequences would be global and almost immediate.
And so we're talking essentially, if you're talking about a doubling price of oil, we're talking about $8 to $10 a gallon of gas.
Probably.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. So there are none of the proponents who talk so glibly about a war, about resolving this, resolving the standoff with Iran, resolving the disputes with Iran, containing the Iranian nuclear program. None of them who say that there's a military option, who talk so glibly about these strikes, ever talk about the economic consequences of what actually would happen if you launched military strikes on Iran.
Well, I'm sure somebody would come up and say that the whole thing is a conspiracy on the part of the electric car companies.
That's right. Now we're getting in more into your sweet spot. What's the energy issue here?
Yeah, really. So, well, let's back up now. We discussed last week the pretext for all this is the idea that the dreaded Iranians might get a nuclear weapon. And where is the evidence for that? Has anything surfaced in the last week that would give us a stronger indication that the Iranians are actually building a nuclear weapon?
No. It's pretty clear that Iran in the past has done research work on nuclear weapons. I think the evidence is overwhelming that was the case, starting
research
around the 1980s.
No actual production.
No actual production, research. So we're talking about modeling of a nuclear warhead. We're talking about preliminary design plans, research into components of a nuclear weapon. For example, let me give you one example. How do you turn? We have pretty good evidence that Iran was investigating and experimenting with how to turn uranium, which they have for fuel, how to turn that into a metal form. The only application for metal uranium is in a nuclear weapon. There is no civilian application for that. So if you're experimenting with that, you know, that's pretty good evidence that you have something in mind other than fuel rods. But most of that work, we now, our intelligence agencies believe, and others as well, the IAEA as well, the International Atomic Energy Agency, believe ended around 2003. Largely because the whole nuclear effort was exposed at that time, and it was disclosed that they were secretly building an uranium enrichment facility in Natanz. So it appears that the leadership made a decision to cancel all the overt weapon work, focus almost exclusively on the ability to enrich uranium, which you enrich uranium to low levels for fuel, but if you just keep the same factory going, the centrifuge plants going, you can enrich it to high level for a bomb. That's what they've been working on for the last 9-8 years, and they've made slow but steady progress. Right now, there's no evidence that they have renewed the weapons work. So there's nothing like a crash program to develop a nuclear weapon as soon as possible. What you have is continued work on the civilian side of the program, which could at some point be turned into a military purpose if they should decide to do so. There's no evidence that Iran has decided to do so.
So basically, we have a deja vu all over again with what happened with Iraq.
Well, it's actually with Iraq, there was suspicions, but no evidence whatsoever that they actually had any programs going. With Iran, you have evidence of past programs, and you certainly have a nuclear material capability that far exceeds anything that Iraq ever had. So I don't want to dismiss this. There's a program there with tremendous weapons potential in Iran, but it's not as if Iran has a bomb now. Most experts believe that if Iran decided to build a bomb today, it would take it at least a year to make the material for the core of the bomb, and then another 1 to 2 years to actually develop a working weapon. So somewhere between 1 and 3 years to have a number of working bombs. So is it possible? Yes. Is it likely? I would say no. And we would see it happening. We would have time to decide on various courses of action. It's not going to catch us by surprise. We're not going to wake up tomorrow and find out that Iran has secretly built a bomb.
So what would the physical realities be of preventing, of a military strike that would accomplish what these people are yelling about in Iowa? What would be the actual on-the-ground situation?
Well, it's very interesting you use that phrase, on the ground, because that's where it ends up. This is a very large operation. They have a very large nuclear facility. This is not like Iraq in 1981, where Israel took 16 jet fighters and bombed a nuclear reactor under development in 1981 in Iraq and knocked out that fledgling program. This is multiple facilities. They're hardened. Some of them are underground. They are defended. We're not sure if we know where all the facilities are, so there could be some secret facilities, secret storage units. It's believed that the Pentagon has worked out a plan. We have plans for everything, as you know, and there are two scenarios for attacking the Iran facilities. One is a 10-day operation of about 1,000 sorties, and the other is double that, about a 20-day operation of somewhere around 2,500 sorties. That is flights of jet aircraft dropping ordnance on the targets. You do that, and then you go, okay, what have you accomplished? Secretary Gates, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, says that the estimates are you would knock back the program by 1 to 3 years. So you don't stop it. You delay it. You delay it at most because of the difficulty of getting at the targets.
And what would the cost in human terms.
And then, so just to get at this, so if you really wanted to stop it, you have to put in ground troops. You have to put boots on the ground to actually seize the land, seize the facility, and prevent Iran from rushing to rebuild, which they almost certainly would. It would then be a Manhattan Project. It would then be pedal to the metal. It would then be build a bomb as quick as you can. So the consequences of a strike might actually be to accelerate a program that is now proceeding in fits and starts. A ground invasion of Iran dwarfs anything we've seen. It's way beyond what we did in Iraq. We're talking about several hundred thousands of troops. It would be a very bloody affair. I don't know anybody who's actually calculated out the civilian consequences of this, but the bombing alone... the bombing, it's unclear what the civilian casualties would be in the bombing, unless you're counting the civilians. Well, you should, the technicians at the nuclear facilities. Most of the nuclear facilities are isolated. They're not in urban areas. They're walled off. And so you would kill perhaps thousands of workers at these facilities. But I don't know if it would go much beyond that. I haven't seen a good study recently done on what the consequences would be. That's actually one of the things Plowshares Fund is looking into funding, a real serious study of the consequences of a military attack on Iran. Nothing good has been done on that in years.
Well, better do it quick.
People are. This is, and the reason you're interested now, and we're all interested in this now, is that people do see this window of danger that is probably open for the next 3 to 4 months, that is during the spring coming up now, is when people fear that Iran's program could get to the point where Israel would feel that it has to launch an attack, and or actions might happen that would either escalate in the way we've described or goad the U.S. into taking launching a strike on Iran. So people are worried about the period between now and summer as a maximum period of danger.
Now, what has the administration's posture been on this? The Obama administration.
Just a few weeks ago, you heard Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, warn about the unintended consequences of war with Iran, and the Joint Chiefs are pretty clear on this. There's no champion in the Pentagon for this. They are fully aware of what this would cost, of what the consequences might be. This would be a fourth war in the Middle East at a time when the U.S. has actually just pulled out of Iraq, is starting the slow pull out of Afghanistan. There's no enthusiasm for this among the military services. But the Obama administration goes to great lengths, largely for domestic reasons, to say that they want to keep the military option on the table. They want to appear tough on Iran. They're appealing to their base as well, and want to keep faith with Israel, want to show that the U.S. is backing up Israel, and so want to keep the military option on the table. But they don't want to use it. So they've gone out of their ways to increase the pressure on Iran through other means, diplomatic isolation, economic sanctions. And I know people in the administration despair of the possibility of actually negotiating a solution with Iran. They think they tried that in the first year of the administration, it failed, and they believe that the only way to go is pressure, is to increase the pressure and to sort of crack the regime one way or the other. Basically, it's a strategy that seeks economic and diplomatic pressure to force a capitulation of the Iranian regime.
What do you think about that prospect?
I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think it ever has in the past. I mean, is it possible? Yes, it's possible. The Iranian regime has its own internal contradictions that could cause it to fall. There could be a Persian Spring in 2012 that mirrors what happened in the rest of the Arab world. That's possible. I just don't think it's likely. It never has in the past. No nation has ever been coerced into giving up its nuclear program, although many, many nations have been convinced to do so. So in the end, what you usually do is the sanctions do serve a purpose if they're part of a diplomatic strategy, if there's a negotiated way out, if there are talks and negotiations and a compromise solution reached on allowing certain nuclear activities to continue, for example, some of the truly peaceful ones like power generation, and others are curtailed or put under strict international inspection. That's possible. But the problem with the administration strategy is they haven't balanced their pressure tactics with an incentive tactics. They haven't indicated to Iran that they're actually willing to negotiate a deal that would leave the Iranian regime in place and find a compromise solution.
We're talking with Joe Cimincione, the executive director of the Plowshares Fund. Plowshares works on nuclear disarmament. It's a wonderful organization. Joe's been on the case for decades. And what does it say about what's your website, real quick, Joe?
It's www.plowshares.org, and it's spelled the English way, Plough, Plowshares.
Yeah. You know, I just saw a Sherlock Holmes story that turned on the spelling of Plowshares.
Oh, really?
Some American came, and he made a headline that spelled it the American way, and that gave away the fact that he was a criminal. So be careful there. Maybe you should have a double website with those spellings. Joe, how has this affected the global dialogue on nuclear disarmament? I know that the administration has taken a verbal stand on nuclear disarmament, but as we know, this administration takes a lot of verbal stands and then follow up. What does this do to your lifelong campaign to get rid of nuclear weapons?
It's interesting you should say that. I'm just starting to work on a piece for Foreign Affairs that I got to finish by the end of the week on the president's nuclear policy overall. Most of your listeners will remember that in April of 2009, he gave his first foreign policy speech of his presidency was delivered in Prague, and it was on nuclear disarmament. It was on his pledge to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. It was the kind of speech I've been waiting my lifetime to hear, a terrific speech.
Uh-huh.
He has failed to actually implement that plan.
Uh-huh.
He has made progress. I mean, he's been going in that direction. You got to give him credit for that. It's been slow and halting, though, largely because one, he hasn't had Iran didn't want to negotiate a deal. This is true. They did spurn U.S. overtures. Russia was much more difficult to negotiate with than we had thought they would be. It took twice as long to negotiate their first nuclear reduction treaty of the administration, which was just passed a year ago. It should have been passed 2 years ago. And then the Republicans took over control of the House and raised their numbers in the Senate and slowed everything down to a crawl. So the president's has in fact reduced U.S. arsenal. Somewhat has reduced the role of nuclear weapons in nuclear strategy, has laid out a plan for doing it, but has not yet fully implemented it. It's interesting, this week he comes back to Washington, and on his desk is a new document from the Pentagon with options for the nuclear forces that they've developed over the last year. It's been a year-long study. That also took twice as long as it was supposed to, but it's finally on his desk. And over the next few months, the president's going to have to choose among those options what he actually wants to do. Most of those options are mush, but I'm told that some of them are actually very far-reaching, and it's a question of whether the president has the political courage to actually try to implement the vision he outlined 3 years ago.
We have been talking with Joe Cimincione. Joe, you wanted to depart us at 2:30. Paul Gunter will be coming in
to talk about
nuclear power, and we will segue from there. How important, let's give you a last question here, since you know I do focus a lot on nuclear power plants. How significant is the fact of all these nuclear power plants, all so-called peaceful atom commercial power plants? What's the impact of them on the nuclear weapons proliferation issue worldwide?
Well, there's no question that the commercial application of nuclear technologies allows a market to flourish that can be used for the proliferation of nuclear weapons. I mean, most of the technologies you need to build nuclear weapons are present in the civilian nuclear power structure. So the enrichment of uranium, for example, the whole big issue with Iran, Iran says it's enriching uranium for fuel rods. And so far that seems to be true. The problem is that you can use those very same facilities to make nuclear weapons. So nuclear power greatly complicates efforts to prevent or eventually eliminate nuclear weapons. And, you know, many, many nuclear weapons programs have begun with civilian power programs.
Well, for example, India.
You know, it's a classic example. We sold them and the Europeans sold them the nuclear reactors that they used to make the plutonium for their first nuclear bombs. There's no question about it. North Korea, you know, research reactors sold to them by the Russians, allowed under the international treaties. They use it to make the plutonium for their nuclear bombs. So it greatly complicates it. The Plowshares Fund doesn't take a position on nuclear power one way or the other, but
I'd like that to change.
You'd like that to change. I don't know how you feel. Let me ask you a question. I do believe that the economics of nuclear power are rapidly turning this into a failed energy technology of the 20th century and not something that's actually going to serve our 21st century energy needs. And I was wondering what you think, Harvey, about the economics, whether you like it or not, whether it's connected to proliferation or not. It seems to me that these plants are increasingly running into budget overruns, schedule delays, and financing problems that are preventing plants from ever even opening. In fact, in Wired magazine today, I was just looking at what the Europeans have done with the closed nuclear reactor site that was being built. They turned it into an amusement park. You can go climb. The cooling tower has been turned into a climbing wall. You can go climb. Go take a look at Wired.com today, and you can see pictures of that.
Wow.
But I was wondering what you think about the economic crisis.
The piece I have today, which is at Huffington,
and
will be at nukefree.org, and is also at freepress.org, talks about that and how nuclear power is being priced out of the market everywhere, and has been being phased out in Japan and Germany for political as well as economic reasons. But, you know, with China, India, Russia, and Great Britain poised to pour government money in there, that's where the problem is. And so we have to prevent the governments, as happened in France. I mean, the whole French industry, which is the so-called poster child for nuclear power, is all government-owned and operated, and that's our big fight now. So economically, you're right. You know, they're not in the marketplace at all, but nonetheless,
it's the government funding that's keeping this stuff alive,
yes,
not the private
absolutely.
Sector. Oh, I see your piece right now. 2012 is the year to finally bury nuke power. Okay, I'll go tweet it out. Thanks, Harvey.
Go to the website, powershows.org, spelled the English way. Thank you so much, Joe. You're truly great. I want to have you back again, okay?
Thanks, Harvey.
We are joined after the break by Paul Gunter, and we'll talk about nuclear power after this. Dana Lyons, Dana Cows with Guns Lyons, singing his version of the Solartopia song. We just had a wonderful half hour with Joe Cirincione of the Plowshares Fund, plowshares.org, spelled the British way with a G-H. And now we're honored to be joined by Paul Gunter of the Beyond Nuclear Organization. Going to talk about nuclear power plants as opposed to weapons, although they certainly do segue together, and we'll talk about that at the start. I have a piece up at Huffington Post today about this very topic. 2012 will be the year we bury nuclear power. Paul, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. Great to have you with us, Paul. You and I have only known each other about 40 years.
Yeah, no nukes.
No nukes, indeed. We were arrested together at the Seabrook nuclear plant in 1989, as I recall. You were the tallest man arrested. And you are with Beyond Nuclear. Tell us a bit about Beyond Nuclear, if you would.
Beyond Nuclear is a nonprofit organization. We're here in the Washington, D.C. area in nuclear-free Tacoma Park, Maryland. And we're focused on the hazards of nuclear power and the inextricable connection to nuclear weapons and the need to abolish both. So we work with communities all around the country, internationally, who are faced with the hazards of nuclear power and nuclear waste. And we're looking to spread the word that the peaceful atom is and always been a bomb.
It is a bomb. In the piece today, a lot of it's devoted to the horrifying economics of nuclear power and what a horrific failure atomic energy is as an generating source when you think about money at all. You've done a lot of work on that. Why don't you tell us your feelings about the economics of nuclear power?
Well, it's always been a failure. I mean, Harvey, you remember that the financial meltdown of the nuclear industry preceded Three Mile Island.
Right.
You know, we had the Three Mile Island accident in 1979, but there were no new reactor orders since 1978 because the industry had already gone through a catastrophic financial meltdown. And that has only worsened over the decades. You know, all the efforts of this very powerful rich nuclear industry to repaint itself as a renaissance industry has failed, and but the concern continues to be that governments are building nuclear power plants, and the effort behind these construction projects is to provide a peaceful atom infrastructure to enrich uranium, generate plutonium for the ultimate reason, and that being to enter the superpower race by obtaining nuclear weapons. So electricity has always been a fleeting byproduct of nuclear power. The legacy of this industry has always been nuclear weapons material and nuclear waste. And far after the last watt of electricity is generated from these things, we will be plagued by the presence of nuclear weapons material and this hideous nuclear waste problem.
Well, what do you think, the title of the piece in Huffington is 2012 will be the year we finally bury nuke power. What do you think the chances are of our shutting this industry in 2012?
I think that the stage is set for the opening act of shutting down nuclear power plants. Clearly, you know, we've now got a precedent-setting situation where the state of Vermont has put its foot down to stop the closure, to stop the license extension of the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant, and the issue is though that the federal government and the centralized electricity industry, you know, they have colluded from the very beginning to promote nuclear power as a way of enhancing our nuclear capabilities in every sense. You know, the delivery of nuclear weapons through nuclear-powered submarines, nuclear aircraft carriers, you know, these are all part and parcel of a brinksmanship that, you know, is bringing us closer and closer to catastrophe. But nuclear power and nuclear weapons are inextricably tied together. And I think we're going to have to break the spell on both in order to really obtain a nuclear-free world.
Well, one thing I forgot to mention when Joe was on was the fact that the West, the French in particular, tried to sell this Shah of Iran 36, I'll repeat that, 36 nuclear power plants. Thankfully, he was overthrown before they got those reactors built. I mean, can you imagine the situation we'd be in today with all these people screaming for war if they actually had 36 reactors in Iran?
It's reminiscent of the rantings of President Nixon when he was threatening to use nuclear weapons against Vietnam.
Right. And, you know, those of us who marched against the war in Vietnam had a great, shall we say, confirmation. You know, a study came out, documents showed that Nixon very definitely would have used nuclear weapons in Vietnam had it not been for the anti-war movement. Having marched and actually been bloodied during the movement against the war in Vietnam, I found that very satisfying.
Yeah, so we can't limit this, these kinds of ravings to religious fundamentalists, but certainly that kind of fundamentalism and brinksmanship is very worrisome when it has nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and you know, it's a big deal. So one of the things, we're with Paul Gunter of the Beyond Nuclear organization, beyondnuclear.org, Fighting Nuclear Power. Paul and I go way, way back to Seabrook, New Hampshire, and the glory days of the Clamshell Alliance, where we succeeded in preventing one reactor from being built. One does operate there more or less, and we're hoping that's going to get shut down as soon as possible. But Paul, tell us a bit about what's happening in Vermont at Vermont Yankee now. The piece at Huffington Post today does discuss it, and it's important that people understand what's going on.
Well, the Vermont Yankee, let's first of all remember, is a Fukushima-style reactor. It is a General Electric Mark I boiling water reactor. Mark I's, as demonstrated at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, are 100% prone to failure of containment in the event of a severe accident. So I think that that concern spreads to all 23 U.S. Mark I's operating in the United States, including Vermont Yankee now. The state of Vermont became concerned not just about the integrity of the design of the Mark I, but the integrity of the company that operated and operates the Mark I there in southeastern Vermont, when the owner and operator, Entergy, out of Jackson, Mississippi, failed to fess up to buried pipe that was leaking radioactive tritium into groundwater and into the Connecticut River, along with other radioactive isotopes like strontium-90, from sheer neglect. They have a significant amount of buried pipe that carries radioactive effluent as a process of normal operation. The pipe being buried was never inspected, never maintained, and as a course of neglect, it started leaking. When the company was confronted by these leaks, they claimed that they didn't have any buried pipe. And as a result of state hearings and disclosures before the Public Service Board, Entergy was found to, basically have misrepresented itself to the state of Vermont. And up in Vermont, when you're lied to, they take that serious. And so,
as opposed to in Washington, where it's just part of the game.
Absolutely. Vermont essentially then had set up a contract, the contract language being set up when Vermont Yankee Power Corporation was initially sold to Entergy mid-2000, that any license renewal application and approval would not only go through a safety review by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but it would go through a certificate of need for the good of Vermonters through the State Public Service Board. And as a result of this breach of integrity, the Public Service Board was ordered by the State Senate after an overwhelming vote not to extend the operating license through a certificate of need as per contract when the 40-year license expires on March 21st, 2012. So, as it stands right now, we have the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has extended a federal license to operate an additional 20 years beyond March 21st of this year, and the state of Vermont has denied a certificate of need, and that is all now before a U.S. federal court.
Now, what is Entergy actually arguing here? I mean, they had the nerve, how they do this with a straight face is beyond me, but can you kind of characterize the argument that the company is making, saying why they get to ignore, or they think they get to ignore, the clear mandate of the state to shut this thing down?
Well, I think that, I'm not going to try to reproduce the legal wranglings that were part of this three-day hearing. Certainly, the judge is going to have to he's going to have to sort this out. But my understanding was that they are looking to argue that federal licensing preempts the state, and that it's the good of the it's in the good of the state to generate electricity from Vermont Yankee. But clearly, I think the overwhelming evidence here is this represents a breach of contract if they try to worm out of this. So
why should a corporation have to honor an agreement it signs with a mere state, since corporations obviously run the country?
Right. Well, you know, a lot of this goes back to the Atomic Energy Act. And
of what year? 1957. Oh, four.
Yeah, 1954. And that it basically sets forth that when nuclear power was initially introduced here, it became a super citizen, with super rights that it now claims can, with the federal oversight, supersede local and state democratic and due process. So I think that's the challenge before us. If in fact, you know, we're going to see an industry that claims to have the ability to even ignore its own contracts.
Well, there you go. I mean, what's a corporation for if not to ignore its own contract? What you're saying is that the Atomic Energy Act of 1954 deemed that nuclear power corporations are not only people, they're super people. Is that
super entities? Yeah, super entities. And let's keep in mind that the principle there is that underlying the peaceful atom, which was announced by President Eisenhower, there are documents dating back to 1952 that show that electricity was only to be a byproduct of the initial agenda was to produce plutonium and enriched uranium for national security, namely, nuclear weapons. So, this ultimately, the man behind the curtain is, making nuclear weapons, and the infrastructure that is presented as the peaceful atom is part of a charade. But it's actually, what drives nuclear weapons development globally now
is commercial nuclear power.
Commercial nuclear power,
right,
is the infrastructure with which to hide a nuclear weapon development program behind.
Right. And who has done that? India has done it. I guess Israel, maybe. Pakistan, apparently. And, of course, we're talking, we talked earlier in the show with Joe Chironcioni about Iran and the whole pretext of going to war with Iran based on the fact that they might be building a nuclear weapon using their commercial reactor program. We're talking with Paul Gunter of the BeyondNuclear.org organization, which works to shut down the nuclear power industry. Paul and I were arrested together at the Seabrook Nuke in 1989. Now, what other reactors have you been arrested at, Paul?
Vermont Yankee. Let's see.
Do you have a guitar case with like all the different stickers?
No, I don't know. No, I really, we've pretty much focused. I've been pretty much focused up in New England with the, these earlier Occupy movements that you and I were a part of.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, I think we could claim to have actually laid out some of the framework and organizational work for establishing affinity groups and, which are part of the Occupy building block now. Right along with the occupying lunch counters in Philadelphia, Mississippi, to occupying construction sites at Seabrook, I think that the foundation of the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Seattle and Occupy other cities, I think that we are now part of a legacy and a history, and I think that that recognition, I think, helps build us momentum for 2012 being the start of a new and stronger Occupy America that has our safe energy policy at heart, as well as our putting America back to work through solar, wind, other renewables, efficiency, conservation. I think, you know, these are all part of an Occupy agenda now.
Yes, very good. And we're talking with Paul Gunter, Beyond Nuclear. I should point out I have a piece today. This is Harvey Wasserman. We're in the Green Power and Wellness Show. A piece at the Huffington Post about 2012, the year we finally bury nuclear power. And one of the things we do talk about in this piece is the job creation realities of renewable energy, of solartopian energy, as opposed to fossil nukes, or what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas. And Paul, tell us a little bit, this is something we've been working on together for a long, long time, about the job-producing capabilities per dollar of investments in renewables as opposed to nukes.
Well, you know, I think just in practical terms, we could go back to our alma mater, Harvey, which is Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant. That's a 1,150 megawatt reactor on the New Hampshire seacoast. Right now, they're going through a license renewal process to extend the operation of Seabrook by another 20 years, beginning. They've put their application in a little early, 20 years before the current one expires. But they're talking about extending now the operation Seabrook from 2030 to 2050. What's interesting is that when they made their application for this extension to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they did not, as required under the National Environmental Policy Act, you know, really fill out the picture of what the renewable alternative looks like.
Well, they're crazy, right?
I'm sorry?
They're afraid to.
They don't want
the public to know what would be involved.
They obfuscated it because right there in the Gulf of Maine, under the a set of memorandums of understanding between the state of Maine and nine other governors council, with the Department of Interior, the Department of Energy, they're talking about putting the equivalent of five Seabrooks of offshore wind in the Gulf of Maine for the service area that Seabrook's trying to to service with its electricity. But
euphemism when we're talking about nuclear plants.
Right. Basically, what's being developed right now, what's being privately financed, what's being accelerated right now is to put Bath Iron Works basically back to work, and the shipyard there, building floating wind turbine platforms that will go out 10 to 50 miles into the Gulf of Maine and begin to harvest the equivalent of hundreds of nuclear power plants in a pilot program that looks to put 5 gigawatts of wind into the service area by 2030 when Seabrook plans to be, coming back online for another 20 years. So wind is about to displace not only nuclear power, but to bring about a boon of jobs to New England.
Well, that's great. Paul, it's been a pleasure. We're getting the hook here with Pete Seeger singing the Solartopia song. Paul Gunter of the beyondnuclear.org website and organization, longtime campaigner for a solartopian future. It's been an honor to have you on, Paul. We've preceded by Joe Cernicioni talking about all things nuclear. If you got a minute, take a look at Huffington Post. My article, 2012 will be the year we bury nuke power. Thank you so much for being with us. Matt, thank you in the studio. Jason, Kyle, and we will be with you again next week at the Green Power and Wellness Show.
Solartopia.